Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com. This is one of our interview series. Today's interview is a special treat. We have Robert Higgs on the phone, and give you just a little bit of a background on Robert Higgs, if you don't know who Robert Higgs is. Robert Higgs is an economic historian and an economist of the Austrian school. Let me just read for you some of the information out of Wikipedia on Robert Higgs. He's a senior fellow in political economy at the Independent Institute. He is editor of the Independent Review. He received his PhD in economics from Johns Hopkins University and has held teaching positions at the University of Washington, Lafayette College, and Seattle University. He's a visiting scholar at Oxford University, Stanford University, and a visiting professorship at the University of Economics Prague, and has supervised dissertations in the PhD program at the Universidad Francisco Marroquin. Please forgive my pronunciation. I only speak English. You probably know Robert Higgs for his tremendous work on his two books. One was Crisis in Leviathan, and the other was Against Leviathan. Crisis in Leviathan gave us this fundamental concept of the ratchet effect, and we're going to talk to Robert Higgs about that during the interview. In addition to all that, Robert Higgs's writings can be found, like I said, at the Independent Institute online. We'll provide a link to the Independent Institute. LouRockwell.com has an archive of Robert Higgs's work, and let me look over real quick and make sure I didn't forget anything. Oh, I have forgot tons of stuff here. You know what? Go over to the Mises Institute and go to the media part and put in Robert Higgs in the search for the media section and download his audio lectures. They will blow your mind. I guarantee, even if you are a well-seasoned libertarian, if you've been in the movement for a lot of years and you really have a good foundation in libertarian knowledge, get over there to the Mises Institute, download his lectures, and listen to him. He will blow your mind, I promise. I was going to read a list of books, but the list is just massive. So at the end of the interview, what you're going to hear is we're going to plug a couple books for Robert Higgs. In addition to that, I wanted to say this interview is being aired Monday morning. That would be October 24th. We actually recorded it Friday evening, but it'll be aired on Monday morning. Now, if you're anywhere in upstate New York or in the area of Canada that's anywhere near upstate New York, you need to get over to St. Lawrence University. I believe that's near Canton, New York. Steve Horowitz is hosting Robert Higgs at the St. Lawrence University. It's going to be Monday, the October 24th, and the following Tuesday, the 25th. And you need to get there and listen to Robert Higgs, and you'll have the pleasure of also having Steve Horowitz at the same location. Now, that's going to be two opposing and yet common views. It'll be very interesting. I would love to be anywhere in the upstate New York area so that I could get over there and actually get to that. One apology in reference to this interview. We're in our new office studio, and I haven't got the acoustics set just right in here yet. You can probably hear the echo, the tinniness in here. It's going to be worse during the interview, and also we had a problem of dog barking constantly through the interview, and you're going to hear phone calls trying to come in. I apologize for the lack of professionalship. I'm working on, you know, with the best that I've got here, and hopefully with time we'll make this a little bit better for you. No further ado and no more excuses, ladies and gentlemen, Robert Higgs interview. Thank you very much. Robert Higgs, welcome to BadQuaker.com. I really appreciate you coming on the show with me.
Thank you, Ben. I'm glad to be here.
Do you mind if I call you Bob?
Bob is fine.
Thank you. I'm thrilled. As a Quaker, a little boring part here on the side, as a Quaker, we don't call people by different titles that men make up and tape onto themselves, and we don't do that kind of thing. How, on the other hand, if I was going to refer to someone in using honor, titles of honor, it would certainly be Robert Higgs, because this is someone who has put in a lifetime of work and deserves the title of doctor and the multiple titles that he does have. But so there's my kissing up part of the show. I just needed to get that out. I don't mean to embarrass you.
I think the Quakers have the right idea on that.
Now, probably the most obvious thing to ask Bob Higgs when you're speaking to him is about the foundational work that has, in my mind anyway, has altered the way of thinking in the libertarian movement and in the liberty movement, and that is the great book, Crisis in the Leviathan, and then the follow-up work, Against Leviathan. In Crisis in Leviathan, you talked about the ratchet effect. And I see that as one of the foundational concepts that a person has to grasp in order to understand the enemy that we face in the state. But I heard you say in an interview that when you were writing that, you didn't necessarily recognize that right off the bat as being the thing that the people were going to focus on in that book. Am I getting that right?
Well, yes and no, Ben. I have mentioned to other people that when I wrote the book, I did not intend for anyone to suppose that a ratchet effect was my invention, because other people had certainly had the idea of the ratchet going back for centuries, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly the idea that governments use crises, especially the crisis of war, as an occasion for them to augment their powers. And so that's an old idea, and as is the rest of the ratchet, which is that they augment them during the crisis, and then they don't give up all those new powers when the crisis passes. And economists had worked with ratchet effects of different kinds in their research and written about them some. There's a book by Peacock and Wiseman on the growth of public expenditure in Britain, and that was published, I believe, in the 60s, as I recall. And they talk about ratchet effects in that history because public expenditure leapt up in Britain during each of the world wars, and then it declined after the wars, but never back to the old trend level that it would have been on had the war not taken place. So they described that experience, and they discussed it some, and talked about why the retrenchment was incomplete. And so ratchets in one form or another had been around. What I was trying to do was several things. One, I wanted to argue against the number of people who were writing about the growth of government in the early 80s when I was writing the book, and basically approaching it as a kind of long-run trend that had to be explained on the basis of some kind of factors that themselves could be viewed as long-run trends. So a number of people were writing, for example, that government had grown because it was an aspect of or related to what is vaguely known as modernization. Things like industrialization, urbanization, change of family farms away, family forms away from extended families to nuclear families, and other things of that sort, things that you can see operating slowly over a long period of time and until eventually they change a great deal. But it seemed to me that explaining how we got from a relatively small government, say, a century ago to a much bigger one now was not simply a trend. It's not that simply periodically abrupt changes during these times of national emergency with incomplete retrenchment, and that kept pushing the size of government and the scope of government, the power of government, to a higher level than it would have achieved had it simply continued along its pre-crisis trend. So that was one thing I was trying to do in talking about ratchets. But the other thing was I was expanding the idea of the ratchet. I mentioned that economists had talked about ratchets in government spending or in government taxation. So they talked about them in relation to fiscal variables that we have data for. But I was trying to show that those kinds of measures are not enough to characterize what I call big government, because governments have ways of substituting, for example, increases in their power for increases in the amount they spend. They have ways of increasing the scope of their authority rather than increasing the amount or the degree to which they exercise authority that they've already had. So there are distinctions I wanted to make, and I wanted to show that the ratchet phenomenon in American history involves all of those things in very various ways from one time to another. And so in that sense, I was doing something that hadn't been done before, which was fleshing out the ratchet effect and showing that it has more than one or two dimensions that we can measure in fiscal variables.
Now, when somebody does what you did, what you just described there, oftentimes it's easy to look back on it and say, well, sure, that makes sense. And especially with the luxury of hindsight that we have now, looking back at the crash in 08 and looking back at the 2000 bubble and looking at the 9/11 and looking at government ratcheting each of those times. But you wrote that at a time when the government was telling us, or at least the media was telling us, and the common story of the day was that the conservatives in power were in the process of cutting government while they were actually doing the opposite.
Yeah, there were a lot of people at the time I was writing the book convinced that the so-called Reagan Revolution had altered the dynamics of the growth of government.
Mm-hmm.
And that was entirely mistaken. It was mistaken just in terms of the facts of what the Reagan administration had done and intended to do. It was not a revolutionary force or collection of political movements or anything like that. It was very, very much chipping at the margins of government at best, and in many ways it was actually making government bigger.
Mm.
But apart from what the Reagan administration itself had achieved or tried and failed to achieve was what seemed to me the logic of the ratchet phenomenon. And one of the things that a number of people seem to miss when they read that book is that the ratchet effect is something that has operated only with a particular kind of ideological background as a condition. Obviously, throughout human history, there have been crises of various kinds, great national emergencies, human emergencies, and they didn't always have a ratchet effect in the growth of government. Otherwise, we wouldn't have found ourselves in the 1880s with a relatively small government. So the way the ratchet effect is operated as a way in which government has grown for the past century and a quarter or so, it is the product of political actions, economic changes in a certain ideological context, and that context is basically the progressive mentality that gained its hold on Americans around the beginning of the 20th century. So absent that, we would not have had the same ratcheting that we've seen. At least that,
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the late 1800s, and that's something that I've it's kind of a thing that's been on my mind lately. And I was talking to Elizabeth recently, and she was encouraging me. That's kind of the reason why we're having this interview today, is because she encouraged me to get a hold of you and talk to you about it. I have been attempting for months, but I have been dragging my feet and busy on other things, to really get into that time frame of the late 1800s, looking at the so-called Gilded Age and the latter part of the Industrial Revolution and the massive explosion of wealth that came specifically. Now, everybody pretty much understands the so-called robber barons made a lot of money, but I think most people have no concept of the quantity of money that was injected into what might be called the working class or the middle class or the non-millionaires, the people who were living in cabins in 1870 and you know, virtual mansions by 1895 or 1900.
And part of that is the fault of the historians, Ben. A lot of work has been done on the late 19th century, and particularly in regard to what is called industrialization, which is a kind of vague concept of the movement away from a predominantly agricultural economy to a predominantly non-agricultural economy. It's not all industry, of course. It's a lot of commercial undertakings and transportation, communication, a lot of other things, as well as just the relative decline of agriculture. But historians have going way back to the 19th century at the time these events were occurring, they've tended to look at industrialization as what Marx and Engels thought it was, as something that was impoverishing the working class. And even people who weren't Marxists tended to look at it that way for a long time. And history books were written with that as a kind of backdrop, if not an argument in the forefront. So people tended to think that this period of rapid industrialization in the late 19th century must have been a bad thing for workers and for farmers. And of course, there was at that time a variety of so-called agrarian protest movements and politicking. So that also made it look as if farmers were somehow being made worse off. But in fact, if one gets serious about the best measures we have of how much was being produced and what forms of production were growing and who was enjoying the increased output that was being produced, it's obvious that this economic growth was very widely spread throughout society in this country. And one reason it's missed is that during this period of 50 years from the end of the war between the states to the beginning of World War I, about 30 million people roughly came into the United States from abroad, almost all of them from Europe. And most of those people who moved here were poor. They came with very relatively little wealth, and so they kept augmenting the lower ranks of the income distribution. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the people who had been here a while, not only native-born people, but also immigrants who had been here a while, and the children and grandchildren of immigrants, mm-hmm. They kept moving up, getting mm-hmm. better off economically, enjoying higher incomes. And if you look at the overall average, which even includes the diluting effect of this constant flow of large numbers of immigrants, you still find that this was a period of very rapid increase in the average income per person in the United States. There had never been such economic growth before, and probably never such a high rate of economic growth afterwards. For that matter, the output per capita was growing about 2% per year. And when you have a growth rate like that, it only takes about 36 years to double.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people could have twice as much income after 36 years when the economy was growing. And, of course, some of them did much better than that. That's just the average.
I was my daughter recently purchased a home in an old part of Dayton, Ohio, where there are a lot of 100-year-old or older homes. And with the purchase of her home, I went through and looked it all over. It was built right at 100 years ago. And I was looking at the beautiful woodwork and the hand-done tiles and just the unbelievable detail that was put into this fine old home. And then we learned a little bit about it. There's only been, in the whole history of the house, there's only been four owners. One of those owners was just transitional for a few months while it moved into my daughter's hands. So technically speaking, there have only been three groups of people that have lived in that home in the 100 years. And we began learning a little bit about these people, and they were what we would consider just a factory working class of the day. And yet this home is in many ways better than a home that we might walk into today that is supported by two people working, a husband and a wife, possibly both working, trying to raise one or two children rather than maybe six or eight in those days. And in this home of 100 years ago, they had things like facilities to for their. They had a day. They obviously had a day maid that probably came in and did some of the housekeeping. And they also sent out routinely, and among that culture, they sent out all of their laundry to be done outside of the home. And we look at that. That's the way they were living as factory workers in Dayton. Nowadays, we have to live with two incomes, and we still, I don't have a maid.
Well, what you're seeing there is in large part a product of the distribution of income at the time. Again, particularly when you have a large influx of unskilled immigrants, you have a lot of people who are unskilled and not capable of producing very much, and therefore a lot of people who are willing to work at relatively low wages as servants or providing other kinds of services like doing people's laundry and so forth. And so you see the same phenomenon today if you go to different parts of the world where the average income is much lower than in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not typical for a middle-class person that in the United States to have a full-time maid, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And it has not been typical for quite a while. But if you go to Mexico, a lot of middle-class people have maids, and that's because people at the bottom of the income distribution in Mexico are relatively very poor compared to the middle class, and so you can hire these people at wages they will accept. When you get to a highly productive economy like the United States, even people at the bottom of the earnings ladder are so productive because of the context in which they work. They work with modern technology and with lots of capital to help them. And so they're very productive, and their pay reflects that, and that pay makes them more costly than even middle-class people can usually afford to pay. So you see when you see the, all the people in service, and even at the time, the last part of the United States where you saw a lot of people working in service was the South, because incomes were not only lower in the South, but the distribution of income in the South was more unequal than
mm-hmm.
in other parts of the country. So you had a lot of these lowest income people who tended to be blacks for the most.
you can actually see some of that if you watch some of these TV shows where they look at property in foreign countries, whether it be Eastern Europe or in Central America, and they look at homes in a price range in the United States that would be just your average suburban home. And then you get into some of those other places and you can get a pretty nice house with servants, with lawn service, with things like that for the same price. Now, one of the things somebody might say, well, of course, we have minimum wage here in the U.S. and that puts us in a situation where we don't force those people in the lower incomes to work those hard jobs. But actually, that's kind of backwards thinking. What you're doing by bringing the minimum wage up constantly higher is you're cutting people off from the workforce, and you're disemploying them, if that's even a word, and you're forcing them to go on government aid of some kind, since you're cutting off that part of competition in the wage earning. Now, I'm not an economist, but you are. So, am I nuts, or is that actually
the... No, not at all. The minimum wage just chops off, all of those people who would want to work legally and whom people would want to hire legally at some wage below the legal minimum. I'm emphasizing the word legal because many people do find work below the minimum wage, but mm-hmm. they have to do it illegally. So there's a kind of black market for low earning people in this country, but for those who work legally, the minimum wage basically excludes unproductive people from opportunities for employment.
Mm-hmm. So it actually harms them and forces them.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Now, there's the offsetting effect in the sense that those people who do get hired make a little higher income than they would without the minimum wage, but mm-hmm. at the same time, they do that at the expense of all those who don't make anything.
Once again, you being an actual economist and me being an armchair economist, I've stated repeatedly, probably almost every time I turn this microphone on, I use the word fascism, and I try to differentiate between, fascism is not necessarily those guys in the shiny boots with funny mustaches and odd movements when they give speeches. That's not really fascism. Fascism is where the corporate world and the government world blend together, and they use each other's power to dominate. And that's what we have in this country, in my opinion, and that's what we've had for at least 100 years. Well, since I often draw the line at the Federal Reserve, but really there was aspects of fascism going all the way back to the Lincoln administration. But again, that's coming from an armchair economist. What's the opinion of a real economist on that?
Well, I've been using the term participatory fascism to describe the U.S. Politico-economic order. I've been using that term for 30 years, and I got that term from a dear, an old friend of mine, Charlotte Twight, who was one of my PhD students at the University of Washington when I taught there. And before Charlotte went to graduate school in economics, she had gone to law school. Nazis and Hitlerian Germany or Mussolini's Italy or other fascist places, because those fascist systems tend to be dictatorships.
Mm-hmm.
But what the U.S. Political elite has done is basically to adopt a cleverer form of control, which gives the mass of people the impression or conviction that they are in control through their participation in politics. And so we're all invited, exhorted even, to go out and cast ballots in elections all the time, and we're all given opportunities to appear before hearings and to express our opinions and our grievances and so forth. So there's a whole apparatus of procedural protest, but if you've ever been involved in this, you probably appreciate how perfunctory and pro forma it tends to be in practice, which is to say that it doesn't really make much difference whether ordinary people protest or object or dislike what the elites are doing. The political elite just through to serve their own interest, and in it by propaganda and organizing the political system in a way that leads people to think they have some control over their destinies, it gains their acquiescence and sometimes even their enthusiastic support. So you know, when you have a dictatorship, you can expect a lot of people who are hurt by it to oppose it, and some to oppose it violently.
Yeah.
But the U.S. system is much better because it placates the great mass of people and makes them actually loyal to the system, the very system which is set up to exploit them for the gain of political insiders and those who have political power or are close to it for one reason or another.
I would think that actually makes the U.S. system in a way more dangerous. Like, for instance, you know, the way that you recognize a rattlesnake right away by his rattle, but something like a cotton mouth that makes no indication that it's about to strike you. That I don't know if that's a good example.
But, I like it.
But you know, there's an obviousness to the old style fascism. With all their showmanship and everything, and their boisterous behavior, but with the U.S., it seems that by convincing the public that that's something other than fascism, we've actually taken on something that's a far greater monster. When it comes to, you know, we're always told how Hitler wanted to take over the world. I'm not really sure he did want to, but that's beside the point. But then we look at what America is doing, and that appears to be what they're trying to do, if we can say a they, without, you know, I mean the state, essentially, not necessarily any individual person. But in that sense, doesn't it seem more dangerous in the long term?
Oh, I think it's much more dangerous. There's a wonderful book written in the 1940s by Bertrand de Jouvenel, who was a French intellectual who early in life was something of a collectivist, and then had a wonderful middle part of his life in which he was an outstanding classical liberal, and then a third part of his life in which he slid back into various inclinations to support collectivist measures. But during this magnificent middle part of Jouvenel's career, he wrote several great books, including one, I think the best of the bunch, called On Power. And one of the things he argues in that book is that over the centuries, the development of democracy and all the elements of democracy, all this due process and procedural participation and voting and so forth, had been was always squashing them more or less mercilessly. But with the development of democracy, people were bamboozled into thinking that they controlled the state. Mm. And that, Juvenal argues, was really their undoing. Because in the old days, they made sure to keep themselves safer from authority, in part because there were a number of intervening institutions between the ordinary individual and the highest level of state authority, whether it was a king, emperor, or whatever.
Yeah.
And these intervening institutions, such as the churches, the various guilds, trade associations, clans, you name it. There were all sorts of things that stood between the naked, solitary individual and the overwhelming power of the head of state. And these things provided a kind of a cushion, in a sense, so that the state could not simply go out and squash all the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
But with the growth of democracy, the intervening institutions have been emasculated, sometimes eliminated, mm-hmm. or pushed aside. For example, in this country, 100 years ago, there were thousands of fraternal organizations of some kind,
mm-hmm.
That provided welfare. They provided medical insurance, unemployment insurance, death benefits, and a lot of other things, including an aspect of social life for their members.
Unemployment.
And this was how people were taken care of,
mm-hmm.
in all the ways that eventually were displaced by what we call the welfare state. And, of course, when you bring on the welfare state, backed up by the power of taxation, these old intervening private groups and associations can't compete anymore. So they're displaced. People abandon them and go over to reliance on, or what I would call dependency on, state provision of the things that people once provided for themselves through voluntary means. And so you more and more have in the modern state nothing intervening between the solitary, powerless individual and the overwhelming power of the total state.
Yeah, actually, taking this back to my daughter's house again, right down the street from where her house is, this was a predominantly German immigrant community around the turn of the century, around Dayton. And right down the street from her, down just a little ways, is their old beer hall. Now, when we say a beer hall, we think, oh, well, it was a bar. But no, it was not a bar. The German beer halls around 1900 in America were those fraternal orders like what you're talking about. They did everything. They had a ladies a thing that went out and made sure that old people were taken care of. If someone became unemployed, they, you know, got them in and got them to work or supported their family in whatever way. And the beer hall functioned in that way in the German community in Dayton, Ohio, to fill all those voids all the way up until all of a sudden, the beer hall got crushed by the progressives and they're outlawing the beer.
Yeah. Well, a similar thing happened in Great Britain where these kinds of fraternal organizations were very widely employed, and when the welfare state began to be built a little over 100 years ago in Britain, they started imposing requirements. And the state started regulating them, and one of the ways they regulated them out was by basically making it impossible for them to serve as drinking clubs.
Mm-hmm.
But the drinking club aspect of these organizations was highly important because when people got together and drank, you know, they developed knowledge of one another and of what was going on. Mm. That was in a way much more intimate than you'd get from more casual conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And with this intimate knowledge they had of their own deserve assistance, or do they deserve a kick in the butt?
Mm-hmm.
And because those old organizations had the knowledge necessary to make judgments like that, they were more efficient. They didn't allow people to, as it were, go on welfare for generations on end as they do now.
Mm-hmm.
The state provides the assistance.
Right. Well, and plus there wasn't an industry of a support industry created, you know, through all the tax dollars of people actually being encouraged to bring in more, fill their quotas of people who need help, in other words.
Oh, yes.
That's, in a sense, we're rewarding welfare workers and social workers and other people in those kinds of positions. We're rewarding them for bringing more people into their fold, so to speak.
Well, particularly if you look at how the Great Society programs worked, you find that time and again they set up a program and sort of opened the doors and hardly anybody came.
Yeah.
And so the next step was sending these people at government expense out to knock on doors and, you know, go here and there. Telling people, look, you know, sign up. We can give you these benefits. You know, we have this free stuff for you. And it actually took some effort to break down the residual inclination of people in this country to avoid the dole. I know that when this sort of thing first became widespread at the federal government level during the 1930s, New Deal. A lot of people still didn't want anything to do with the make work or the federal dole programs, the WPA, and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
My father, for example, was a person who would never have signed up for that kind of state assistance. To him, that was a shameful.
Yeah.
Thing to do, and he was by no means unique in that respect. The shame of being on the government dole was something that lasted a long time, but eventually the state kept hammering away and explaining to people that they were schmucks if they didn't take advantage of these free goodies. That eventually, I think, that kind of shame was more or less demolished.
I think it's hilarious and yet at the same time tragic and almost can almost bring you to tears if you think about it too much, that at the same time that you referred to there in the 60s, that they were literally, in a sense, they were literally going out and pushing the government programs through the, you know, free samples, so to speak, the same way so-called drug pushers have been accused of going out and so-called pushing their drugs by giving free samples and then getting people hooked. And the same time that America was coming into a serious drug problem in the 60s, the government was in essence creating another type of dependency that's in ways far worse for society than whatever may have occurred because of the drug use.
Oh, yes. Well, eventually, of course, people came to recognize that the dependency was a serious problem with these programs, but by the time they admitted it, it was too late. Mm-hmm. You'd already had two or three generations of people who had indeed become dependent on them, and I don't know if you've had much contact with people who live that way.
Mm-hmm.
On all sorts of government handouts, but if you ever circulated with those people, the first thing you notice is how extremely well-informed they are.
Yeah.
Everybody knows about where to get free this and where to get free that, and they just snap up every new thing that comes along.
Yeah.
And that is their, in a sense, their form of entrepreneurship, which is really pathetic.
Yeah, and I've blamed, I have actually said, though, that it's almost wrong to blame them in a sense because, I use the example of squirrels. I put food out for the squirrels here around my house, and I put food out almost every day for the squirrels. And so the squirrels show up expecting food. And that's a natural behavior, you know. If you train them by providing the food for them, then don't blame the squirrels when they show up for the food.
Well, I think it's certainly the case that these programs are not created in response to popular clamor. They were almost all top-down. They were the work of do-gooders and government officials or people with political connections who had come by the belief that somehow the world would be a better place if the government operated programs like this. So certainly the New Deal and the Great Society came about generally in that way. Mm-hmm. Even something like the Social Security system. Well, there was no great political movement for a Social Security system during the 1930s. It was almost all a top-down thing by people who knew what had happened in Germany and other European countries and thought the United States is just backward to not have the same kind of programs.
Yeah. Let me shift gears real quick. I'm about to run out of time, and I want to use every minute that I have with you. While I have you on the show, I wanted to ask you about the Occupy Wall Street folks. What's your opinion of what's going on with them?
Well, I should first say I haven't spent a lot of time reading the news about them, so I don't have a truly well-informed appreciation of who's doing what. I have read some news accounts. I'm of two minds about them. On the one hand, anything that discomforts the establishment, I'm inclined to like.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, the fact that large groups of people are coming out to express their dissatisfaction, it gives me a positive feeling. On the other hand, from what I've read about their various demands and their sort of understandings of why there are problems and what caused these problems and who's to blame and so forth, leads me to believe that a large proportion of these people are extremely misguided about what has happened and why, and even more misguided about what they want, because it seems that most of them really are calling on the government to hand out some more benefits to people like them. And the problem, in my judgment, is not so much Wall Street as such, not banks as such. The problem is fascism. And even though fascism is a kind of merger of corporate interests and state interests, it's always a merger in which the state has the upper hand.
Mm-hmm.
So the progressives always see the corporations as running the government, but I think that's really wrong if you have to do it in black and white terms. Obviously, there's a lot of subtleties involved in the relations between corporate bigwigs and state bigwigs, but nevertheless, the state has vastly more resources. It has more legitimacy. It has more power.
Mm-hmm.
It has more brute force than any one or all corporations can muster.
Mm-hmm.
And so certainly it was the case in Germany. It was the case in fascist Italy that fascism is always, in a way, a fraud because, it preserves the appearance of private property, and it allows some private property holders, some big corporations, to get rich.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, they do so only when they operate as the state is willing to tolerate.
Yeah, the state is really the puppet master pulling the strings.
The state is the institution that they should be protesting above all.
Yeah.
And if they wanted to protest the big banks as master thieves and junior partners in the fascist setup, I would think they're much closer to the target.
Yeah, I've compared it to, you know, Thoreau said about the striking the branches, and I think that's really what they're doing. They're hitting branches and patting themselves on the back because they're fighting with the branches rather than ever realizing that there's a root under their feet.
Yeah.
Let me give you an opportunity to tell my listeners how wrong I am on something. I'll lay out something I see, and I think I could be wrong, but I think you see things slightly different than me. So I'll give you the opportunity to correct me in front of my listeners. I see the state itself and its attempt to give us law and give us justice. I think the state is an immoral institute, and morally speaking, the state is unstable. I think its attempts to control the economy are going to be failures because I think the state itself, economically speaking, is unstable. And I see everything that the state tries to put its tentacles into, it's not good at them. It's very unstable. And I see some point in the future, not just the American state, I think, you know, far beyond any one country, but I see the process of the state as eventually getting to the point of where it can't support its own weight and it will collapse. And I've often said that if we can go a full generation without the state, we'd never pick it back up again. And I base that on, you know, the thousands of years we existed prior to the invention of the state. And then, you know, then it came along and infected us. Do you see me as just being a wild dreamer that there's just no way that the state is ever going to fall in on itself like that?
I am very doubtful that the state is going to pass from the stage. It's certainly the case, as you say, that the state is not good at doing what it purports to do. And from time to time, that creates a problem for the state because it doesn't honestly come out and publicize the fact that the purpose of the state is extortion.
Right.
It's a protection racket. And in that sense, the state is almost always a raving success. And one would have to say that the American state is by far the most successful ever.
As a bunch of raging thieves.
It rakes in more loot in a year than practically all the rest of the thieves, pickpockets, and highwaymen in history have ever, in the course of human history, mm-hmm. managed to get. So it's incredibly successful at wrenching wealth away from the producers and handing it over to people who didn't produce it. And that's its purpose. Everything else is secondary. There's no doubt, of course, that the state produces a variety of goods and services that have some value to some people.
Mm-hmm.
But you could say the same thing about the sheep mm-hmm. in a shepherd's flock.
Yeah.
The shepherd may produce shelter. He certainly provides food. He may ward off wolves. There may be lots of things that the sheep value, but they're still sheep. And they're only going to be cared for so long as it were, the shepherd gains from running the sheep business.
Mm-hmm.
And the state is similar to that. It provides Mm-hmm. But of course it fails. It's not really trying to do those things. Now the question is, can it continue to get away with this scam indefinitely? And I think no. All states historically ultimately fail in some way. They're either defeated by other states, or they're overthrown by internal revolutionaries. But what happens is that when a state fails or is defeated, it simply reconstituted.
Mm-hmm.
And so one has to believe, you know, if one is a utopian kind of anarchist, I'm an anarchist in the sense of that being my ideal.
Mm-hmm.
I wish it could be achieved. I don't believe it can be, and that's probably too long a story to tell you about, but nonetheless, if you're the kind of anarchist who thinks we can actually create anarchy and it will be viable, mm-hmm. it will be sustainable, I think you're really up against a serious problem, and that is that no matter what the nature of society, some of its members will have, by definition, a comparative advantage in the exercise of violence and fraud.
Mm-hmm. Which is the state.
And that's what the state is. It's the people who have a comparative advantage in the use of violence and fraud and use that advantage for the purpose of getting wealth at the expense of... I just don't see any way... I mean, it's really impossible to create a situation in which no one has a comparative advantage in doing that. It's by definition the sort of thing that somebody has to have, unless everybody is absolutely identical in every respect, which is unthinkable.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have to have, in order for anarchy to be sustainable, even if it were ever brought into operation, you'd have to have people who were so ideologically committed to it that they would be willing to abstain from what otherwise might be personal gains in wealth and power if they were to depart from anarchist ideology. And I just don't see people as having the strength of character anywhere in the world to resist that temptation.
That's a great temptation.
It's always worked on people in the past.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show, and I want to thank you. You gave me a whole hour, and I certainly appreciate the time that you gave me. And I know, speaking for the listeners, I know they appreciate it because, you know, I could already see the excitement coming when I teased that you were going to be on the show with me. So I really want to thank you for your time, and words can't express enough how much I want to thank you for it.
Well, I'm very happy to have spent the hour talking to you, Ben, and I hope someone who listens to the podcast gets something worthwhile from it.
Let me just throw in one other thing while I've got you on the line. And now, the Mises Institute, I believe, just re-released a book of yours. Am I correct on that?
Yes. They have made available my first book, which was published 40 years ago. It's called The Transformation of the American Economy, and it's a very brief analytical survey of the development of the U.S. economy from the war between the states to the First World War. So it deals with some of the things we were talking about half an hour ago about mm-hmm. the Gilded Age and related things. So that's now available again. People can either buy it from the Mises Institute, or if they don't want to buy it, they can just go to the Mises Institute's website and read it free.
Mm-hmm. And I'll put links to that. What was the last book that you finished?
Well, the book I published most recently is called Neither Liberty Nor Safety. And that came out, I guess, in 2008, I believe, 7 or 8, I'm getting,
mm-hmm.
I've got so many pages stuck in my book, I can't even find the copyright page. But in any event, it was just a few years ago, and neither Liberty nor Safety, and it's available from all the usual booksellers, as well as directly from the Independent Institute, which published it. And I've got a new book coming out. I'd like to advertise a little bit, called Delusions of Power. And this is a book that contains some of my recent work on the state, war, and the economy. So it's the same general subject matter I've been writing about for a long time, but there's always new things to work on or topics to delve into more deeply, and so I've continued to do that as my time has permitted, and this book, Delusions of Power, will be published next March. So if anyone has found my past writing interesting, they might want to keep an eye out for this new book.
That sounds great. Well, thank you once again for coming on the show with us, and for all the listeners out there, be sure and get over to badquaker.com, and we'll provide links to all those things. Bob, thanks again for coming on the show.
You're very, very welcome, Ben. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks a lot.